RadioInfluence.com.
You're listening to Crush Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crushell. Get in on the talent grid and follow him on Twitter at Jeff Crush. Now, here he is, the Crusher.
And welcome to Crush Performance. Jeff Crushell here. A really big show today, so I'm glad everybody's joining us. Hope you're having a fantastic Wednesday. Hey, if you want to get to us, questions, comments, smart remarks, do it. CrushPerformance.com is the location. Blogs, Twitter, podcasts, connections, and also you can sign up for our weekly newsletter where we connect you to the world of performance, sending out great performance information each and every week. Today on the show, I think, which is a very important topic, the dangers of trying to predict future success and what good talent ID looks like. We're also going to look at the changing role of parents in development and sport and deliberate practice, the role it plays in development and what people should be thinking when it comes to their competition and their practice time. We'll be joined later in the show by Dr. Joe Baker, professor in the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences at York University, to discuss these topics and much more. But for now, text question of the day. I really want your input here, so get to us. The text is 101260. Standard text rates apply. But do you think it's better to hold your kids back a year in school or in sport to get an edge? Or do you think it's better to have them play up if they're able to get experience and to be pushed in terms of their overall development? There's some very, very interesting trends going on. We'll talk about it today. But I'd like your opinion. Do you think we've gone too far? Is it fair to the kids? Is it fair in sport in general, to hold your kids back a year, let's say in kindergarten, we're seeing it. In grade one, we're seeing it. Grade five, we're seeing it. In college, we have red shirting for sure. It happens all the time. But do you think it's better to hold a kid back a year to give him an advantage in sport? Or let him play up if they're able? Get to us. Let us hear your opinion, 101260. Predicting the future success of athletes in sports, there are great dangers here, especially at the early age. You know, when we're projecting athletes close to their draft ages, their signing ages, where they're, you know, sort of dedicated to a sport, going NCAA or trying to get into the pro ranks of their favorite sport, the top scouts working for some of the richest teams in the world have a wide range of accuracy. Or inaccuracy, depending on how you look at it. It's between 2 to 16%. And the younger the age, the harder and less accurate the prediction. So again, it makes me wonder, you know, how much emphasis we should be putting on young kids in terms of their overall development. There are just too many variables. When parents and coaches try to identify talent at a young age, what are they really looking at? Well, I'm going to tell you right now, it's not necessarily talent. We're looking for things like speed, power, strength. And those are more related to growth and development than actual talent, especially in the early ages. We all know the difference that we have in the developmental ages of these young athletes. And when we try to evaluate them early on for talent, we have to be very, very careful what we're looking at. So when they think we're seeing talent, they're actually seeing growth in development, because we know it changes over time. People are constantly looking for ways to give their kids an edge, but are we taking it too far? Is it right to hold your kids back in school to gain an advantage in sport? Again, it's a big, important question. It's happening right now in Canada, in the States, and around the world. And it's not unusual for some college athletes to sit out of competition for a year to get game ready. I mean, we redshirt kids all the time. It's actually getting less popular in college, but we're still seeing it. Part of it has to do with finances and scholarships and availability of those spots on those college teams, but it is still happening, and it kind of makes sense at that level. You got a young guy coming into a college setting, redshirt him for a year, let him learn the systems, let him get a bit stronger, and then let him step in and have an impact. It makes a lot of sense, but man, in kindergarten, grade one, grade two, at 5 years old, very alarming and concerning to me especially. I'd like to get your opinion. Again, text 101260. Some parents believe their children get a leg up in competition as young as 5 years old, and they're being held back in hopes that it'll give them an advantage in sport on the court or on the field. But the redshirting detractors out there warn that parents may be gambling with more than they realize. Does it really work? A short time ago, Bob Holtzman reported on this very topic for Outside the Lines. Let's have a listen and see what they have to say, and we'll carry on the discussion after this. Listen to this.
Like a lot of college athletes, quarterback Jameis Winston redshirted his first year in college.
Winston sacked at the 30-yard line by the freshman corner, Brian Fields.
Duke cornerback Brian Fields redshirted too. What makes Fields' story notable is that his redshirt year came in the eighth grade. The move was orchestrated by his father, also named Brian Fields.
He's always been an A student. That's never been an issue with him.
So this was just for sports?
It was just for sports.
And that extra year, I mean, what a difference it made as far as his body type.
When Brian Fields was 12 years old, his father made a decision that more and more parents are making. He had his son repeat eighth grade. The hope was that an extra year would give Fields more time to develop as an athlete and earn a college scholarship.
Take out the athletic part of it. If we say, oh, we repeated eighth grade because he's struggling in math, nobody would have a problem with it. Oh, that's great parenting. You did a great thing for him. But you throw sports into it, now all of a sudden, some people have a problem with it.
You know, he couldn't do this his sophomore year. You know, he just physically couldn't do it.
It was a little tough. All my friends were in high school, you know, and I got a lot of questions like, oh, why are you still in eighth grade? You know, why aren't you up here with us?
You'd hear rumblings, you know, rather be from different people on the outside, parents, other players or what have you. But how I explained it to him was really, they're not part of our plan.
What was the plan?
What we looked at was you get very few opportunities in life that you can manufacture time. We were in a position and had the opportunity to give him another year to work towards achieving his goal.
In Wheeling, West Virginia, Chad Anthony has manufactured time as well. But he didn't hold back his son in eighth grade.
Is that everything? Helmet, glove, right?
Yep, it's in the bag.
Troy Anthony repeated kindergarten.
How big of a factor was sports in this decision?
It was a pretty big factor. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't.
People, when they hear that you had your son repeat kindergarten for the benefit of sports, probably be some people that roll their eyes at that.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, I can imagine. And I don't think they understand.
Troy Anthony is a second grader now, the shortstop on his baseball team, the leading scorer on his basketball team.
I just hate to be cast as this sports villain, you know what I mean? If he chooses to be a participant in sports and he wants to pursue sports, we want to give him an opportunity to excel in sports. And I think that I've done that so far.
According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the number of six-year-olds in kindergarten is now five times what it was just a few decades ago. There are a number of reasons for the increase, but no hard numbers to show how often sports is a factor.
I think he's has the body to do well, and his physique, I guess. I mean, his body right now, he passes the eyeball test, I guess is the best way to put it.
Bob Hurley has been coaching high school basketball in New Jersey for more than 40 years.
Roll hard to the rim, not tiptoe into the lane. Let's go.
He's won 27 state championships and is a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame.
You know, I have a trained eye, and to watch the five-year-old, I can't figure out what we have there other than the five-year-old. The really good players used to play up in age. Guys used to play against the better, older players. We have turned this completely around.
Keep the pivot foot down!
New Jersey is one of a number of states where it's become common for elite basketball players to repeat a grade in middle school. Most states limit high school eligibility to 4 years, but the clock doesn't start ticking until ninth grade.
People are always looking to give their children some type of edge. It used to be academically that people would have tutoring and all kinds of other things, but now we're in a world where the same things hold true athletically.
Joe Baker is a professor of kinesiology and health science at York University in Toronto.
If I came to you and said, what would you recommend I do with my children? Should I hold them back? What would you tell me?
I would say no. And the reason for that is the effect, as consistent as it is very small.
For years, Baker has been studying something called the relative age effect, which suggests the oldest children on a team or in a class generally do better. But recently, he discovered that in many cases, including the NHL draft, It's the younger players in an age group who are excelling.
If you're the smallest one, I mean, you have to learn how to be faster so that you don't get creamed into the boards and you're playing hockey. That might teach you how to be a superior athlete, a better player. If you're always the biggest player, there's not as much impetus for you to make those kind of creative solutions.
Baker says holding back a child strictly for sports could backfire down the road.
We know that too much heavy-handedness on the side of parents is a great recipe for dropout of sport as soon as kids get the ability to make their own decisions.
But that's not how Duke sophomore Brian Field sees it.
Staying back that eighth grade year, I really developed some confidence. I was kind of like the man on that team, you know. I was just a bigger, faster, stronger kid than I was the year before.
Still, Field says he didn't catch the attention of the Power Conference schools until late in his high school career. And his dad says Duke may never have been an option had they not manufactured time.
It wasn't until October of his senior year that Duke offered him.
October of his senior year, He would have been in college already.
He would have been in college already, wherever that may have been. So in hindsight, him getting that extra year is why he's at Duke now.
But redshirting his oldest son works so well for Brian Fields, he says he may decide to have all four of his children do the same thing.
We have a plan in place. We know that it can work. And again, it's just about maximizing the opportunity.
I have middle schoolers. If I were to ask you, hey, you've been through it, what's your advice? What is your advice?
I'd say absolutely do it. Worst case, you get him home for an extra year before he graduates. That's the worst thing that can happen.
There you go. A very interesting segment by Bob Holtzman. And yes, text coming in. Canada is different from the U.S. because we set divisions by your birth date, not your grade. A very strong point. And that's why today I wanted to get Dr. Joe Baker on the show to talk about this relative age effect that's really, really impacting Canadian players and any sporting organization where there are birth date cutoffs. So stay tuned. After the break, we'll be joined by Dr. Joe Baker to further discuss the dangers of trying to predict future success, what good talent ID looks like, the changing role of parents in development, and later on, deliberate practice. Right after this on Crush Performance. Stay tuned, everybody.
Radio Influence strives to bring you the best in digital media broadcasting. We've got something for everybody. National sports radio talents such as the fabulous Sports Babe and Rich Herrera. Huge podcasts like the Don Tony and Kevin Castle Show. And the MMA Insiders with Jason Floyd and Sam Kaplan. New shows like Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill. Entertainment shows like LOL with Nancy Alexander. And shows that'll make you think like Dangerous Conversation with Scott Ledger.
We've got you covered.
You can find all our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.
Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.
Find out what it takes to be a top performer. Get the Crush blog, podcast, and newsletter at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to Crush Performance, the website, crushperformance.com. Go there. Blog, Twitter, all the hookups, and you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter where we hook you up with all the great performance information that's coming into the internet in the world. So listen, I want to put a shout out to Todd and all the great people at TD Bank who had me out Thursday talking performance down in Fort Edmonton Park. There was a group of their top leaders, and what a great time. You know, talking performance is always fun. Today's no exception as we get into a couple very interesting topics. The text question of the day, get to us 101260. Do you think it's better to hold your kids back a year to get an advantage in sport or let them play up if they're able? We're seeing some alarming trends, and joining us right now is an expert in the field, Dr. Joe Baker from York University. He's a professor at the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences. Dr. Baker, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
Well, listen, it's a very interesting topic. We know how passionate parents are about their kids and creating opportunities, but do you think sometimes that we go a little too far? We just listened to the great segment from Outside the Lines that you were on with Bob Holtzman, and it was kind of alarming just to hear some of the attitudes. So it's an interesting place we're at in terms of developmental sport.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that when you listen to that Outside the Line segment, there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all strategy that's going to work for every developing kid. And so, you know, one of the things that we do in our lab is to take a real sort of scientific approach to this question, and not to sort of say this is the approach that's going to work for everybody, but what does the evidence say is the best approach? And so when you look at things like redshirting, the evidence is pretty clear that when you redshirt, there are all sorts of risks involved with that sort of process. And so I think, you know, if parents are aware of these risks and they're sort of making those decisions, weighing the pros and cons, then it might be something they want to try out, as long as they're aware of the risks associated.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting because, you know, as parents, we don't necessarily even know to think about that kind of information. We just say, okay, here's an opportunity that kind of makes sense. Let's go for it, without really, you know, balancing the ramifications of the decision.
Yeah, and on the surface, it looks like a really simple decision, right? If redshirting is a process that started in varsity sport, where you would have, because the window of eligibility is so limited, they would have athletes sit a year so that they could learn the game, learn the system of the sport that they're being engaged in, and then the next year they would start their eligibility, so that clock didn't start ticking before they sort of knew where they were and what their job was. And so we've started to see it roll back. In the ESPN piece, they talk about someone who held their kid back in kindergarten, and so we're starting to see those kind of scenarios, which don't make any sense at all. You know, one of the difficult things about talent is we understand it in such a limited way that to be able to say when your kid's 4 years old or 5 years old, yeah, they have it, they've got talent. They're probably seeing something else. They're probably seeing some sort of bias when they think they're seeing talent. That's what our research would suggest anyway.
Well, and some of the research that you've produced, I thought it was pretty interesting. You know, when we talk about, you know, trying to identify talent, especially for young kids, you know, you're right. It's not necessarily talent. We look at speed. Hey, that kid's fast. And that kid's got, you know, some pretty good power. That kid's a little bit stronger than the other kids. But, you know, at 6, 7, 8, even 10, 11, 12 years of age, man, we know that's going to be a wash down the road. So we have to be really careful of the type of labels we put on kids early on. And I think it actually comes back and maybe puts a little extra pressure on the kids, which isn't necessarily always the best thing to do.
No, for sure. And I think one of the things that we've done a lot of work on is this thing called the relative age effect. And, you know, if you think about the way that we've set sport up, where we put kids into 1 year or 2 year age categories, and we do this for a good reason. You know, you think of the way education is designed now with the same sort of philosophy versus the one room schoolhouse where everybody was sort of jumped in together. Of course, splitting people up into age categories makes sense, but when you do that, you create this artificial distribution between the oldest and the youngest person in that group. And what that does is when you make decisions about who's more talented, or in the case of education, who's more gifted or who's got a learning disability, the ones that are more often identified as having talent or as being gifted are the ones that are the oldest in that group. And the ones that are identified as maybe not having talent or having some sort of learning disability are the youngest ones in that group. And it makes sense, because one of the things we've seen in sport as a system is we start to look for talent earlier and earlier. And when you do that at 5, 6, 7 years of age, a 1 year difference in maturation and growth between people that are being compared as if they're equals is a huge amount of their lifespan.
It is, especially at that age. We're talking with Dr. Joe Baker, Associate Professor at the School of Kinesiology and Health Science at York University, talking about relative age. Well, you know, we've sort of dealt with this topic before on the show, and some of the data out there is actually pretty alarming. You know, we talk about this self-fulfilling prophecy that we hear of when we do get those older kids getting an advantage over the younger kids in these sort of age segmented, you know, sports. And that is something that I think was pretty alarming. You know, when we talk about the fact that these older kids who are literally up to a year older can get a distinct advantage and then be maybe misrepresenting a false talent, but they get more attention, they get onto the teams, more ice time, maybe even better coaching, and then automatically, because of the environment, they get better. So right now, the mindset, or I guess maybe the thinking, is relative age gives a distinct advantage. But some of your research tells a very different story.
Yeah, and I think the research is pretty clear that it's not quite as simple as it seems on the surface.
Right.
And that if you're a relatively younger person and you can survive in this system that seems to be biased against you, you know, sort of providing better opportunities for kids that are relatively older, if you can be the relatively younger kid surviving in that system, it does look as though you become a better performer at the end of the journey, right? The kids that are relatively younger are more likely to be drafted earlier in the NHL. They're more likely to make more money in professional soccer in Europe. They're more likely to have longer careers in sports like European handball. And so what this collectively says is that the process of simply holding someone back so that they appear to be bigger and faster and stronger compared to their peers might actually limit their opportunities for skill acquisition, which is the ultimate purpose of the journey, is to provide them with the best environment so that they can acquire the highest levels of skill. And when you're the biggest person in a cohort, you're not challenged in the same way you are as if you're the youngest person. And there seems to be some advantage, and for some people, whatever that is, the characteristics that they have, maybe it's resiliency, maybe it's that sort of tenacity that they have that just puts them into that situation where they seem to thrive.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because, you know, I think that you're absolutely right when we look at the kids that survive. And I kind of like that comment, because for the younger kids that do survive, you're right. They've had to battle to get there. They've had to really learn how to learn and take advantage of maybe every strength that they have. So it kind of makes sense. And when you talk about sort of that NHL level, that sort of signing age, I know in Major League Baseball, we monitor this very closely, because baseball is one of those sports with that age cutoff. When it gets to that upper level, it's really a wash between the months of the year where kids were born and signing pro. I think we see the same thing in the NHL. So it's very interesting how it really comes out at the end of the game when kids are moving on to the pro or higher ranks of sport.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we see a related effect when you look at families of that have multiple players that play professional sport. A lot of the times it's the youngest person in that family that's the superior performer. And we see this with a study that we just did with Australian and Canadian high-performance athletes, that if you're later born in your birth order, you're more likely to become an elite athlete. And we think that it's related to the same thing, right? You're playing with older, your older siblings, peers. You're probably the smallest person in the game, and so that provides you with the impetus to think about things in a more creative way or figure out unique solutions, and those are the things that pay off in the long run at the professional level.
See, now I know why I kick my brother's butt all the time, right? My older brother. This explains everything. Right? It's sort of the trial and error. Hey, man, I was the result of the... So this is great news. Now I can explain it to him why I'm so much better than him.
Just don't involve me in any Thanksgiving discussion.
Yeah, right. No, that one will get nasty for sure. But that's an interesting point within families, because boy, oh boy, you know, we all know those families who have, you know, multiple kids, or the kids of the father who go on to play in sports. And let me just ask you this. How important is environment in this? So let's say we take a young performer, a young passionate hockey player, a baseball player, a kid that just loves the game, and we put him in an environment where we really do challenge him. I think we might have a better shot at actually, you know, helping this kid succeed to, you know, achieving some sort of goal in his game. Does that make sense? The I guess what I'm saying is the power of environment.
Yeah, the environment is critical, and so that's not that's not the same thing as saying genes aren't important, because they obviously are. But if we look at the things that are actually within our control as coaches, as parents, as athletes, the environment is the thing that we can control. And so, the environment is critical. And I think, oftentimes we get that sort of gets lost in the message that if you don't have the genes, if you don't have the family background, you're not gonna make it. Well, we can control a lot of that stuff by optimizing environment, which sounds like a simple thing, provide the person with the most challenging environment so that they're always sort of adapting to the greatest extent possible. But the challenge is something that needs to be really carefully thought out. So it's got to be developmentally appropriate. And here's where we get into the difference between the science of coaching and the art of coaching. Good coaches know, sometimes implicitly, and they can't describe it to you, they know how to change the way they design practices to challenge athletes in different ways. And I think it's really hard to measure that from an objective scientific standpoint, but that doesn't mean it's not real.
The art of coaching. Buck Showalter said something interesting, not in 2015, but at 2014 spring training, when we were talking about the sabermetrics and breaking down the stats and trying to draft and predict future success of players based on their past numbers. He said, look, all this science is really fine and dandy, but don't forget about the art of the game. And you sort of say that again. We're talking with Dr. Joe Baker, professor at the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences at York University. That's a very interesting comment, Dr. Baker.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we've sort of seen repeatedly as scientists is that we start figuring things out that coaches have known for decades, and we just find a way to measure it and to design scales to help coaches assess it better. But if you go back to them and say, hey, we found this thing, most of the time coaches know about it and they're already putting it into their practice.
Well, interesting. So let's get into sort of the pathways in the environment you talk about. Canada's sort of on the cutting edge here. I really am proud to be, sort of on the fringe anyway of the Canadian sports system, because we're doing some cool things. Let me ask you this. We talk about age-appropriate development. The long-term athlete development program that Sport Canada has put together, I think, has been a really good guide for a lot of young coaches and maybe even athletes and parents that might not really have the insight or the background in the sports science. And to have the parallel coaching development, I think, is a real powerful thing. What's your feeling on the long-term athlete development in terms of the Canadian model?
Yeah, I agree. It's a good model, and one of the ways you can tell it's a good model is the way that other countries around the world have either tried to copy it or to just sort of redesign it so that it fits their system. And so, yeah, I think it is a good model. And again, to come back to one of my earlier points, there's not going to be a single model that's going to fit every athlete's scenario. And so if we think about it in terms of a general model that's going to have the greatest good for the most amount of developing athletes, it's probably one of the best models in the world for doing that.
Yeah, I agree. Proud to be Canadian right here. Do you think the model has really taken the pressure off the parents? One thing I know that you're passionate about and talking about is the role of parents in development in sport. And that's a changing environment as well.
Yeah, it is, and I would argue that sometimes it's not a change for the better.
Right.
If you look at the, I'm not sure how old you are, Jeff, but I'm certain that the way that you experience sport when you're developing is different from the environment that your kids are experiencing now. And so, one of the things that's changed there, in addition to the system itself changing with a greater emphasis on talent identification and things like early specialization, is that parents have changed, and so there is a lot more helicopter parenting. There's a lot more pressure from parents and kids. We see this in negative behavior of parents in the stands of hockey and soccer games. And so parenting is becoming this monstrosity in terms of athlete development that we need to start to get a handle on. And part of this is scientists' fault. We don't really understand the optimal way for parents to interact with their kids. But some of the advice that I give to parents is that they should take two steps back for every one step forward, because part of what develops an elite athlete is autonomy and figuring things out for themselves and independence. And when parents are over-involved with their kids, they're less likely to have the kid develop those qualities.
Very interesting conversation, and I think something that really, really is close to the hearts of many parents out there. And, with the best intentions, sometimes we go down the wrong road simply for lack of knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. This isn't to demonize parents, because I know they're coming at this from a positive place. They want what's best for their kids, but without good understanding of what best behavior looks like, I think too many parents think that over-involvement is the way to go. And most of the research suggests that over-involvement is a perfect recipe for dropout, for disengagement, for frustration, or for increased pressure.
Dr. Joe Baker from the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences from York University. Very, very interesting topic. When we come back, why don't we carry on the conversation? I'd like to delve into deliberate practice, and maybe touch a little bit more on this concept of autonomy and development after the break, if you're okay to stick around.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, great. Okay, everybody. Well, do so. Stick around yourselves. We'll cut out for a quick break, and we'll be back with more Dr. Joe Baker talking about deliberate practice and talent development right after this on Crush Performance.
Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. Each week, we look at the latest trends and research coming out of the performance world to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it takes to achieve human maximum performance. And athletes, now you can do just that as Crush Performance presents the Sport Matrix, the program for top performance in sport. For more information, go to crushperformance.com and join us Wednesday evenings at 7, Saturdays at 4. We're here to help you think like an athlete.
Radio Influence strives to bring you the best in digital media broadcasting. We've got something for everybody. National sports radio talents such as the fabulous Sports Babe and Rich Herrera. Huge podcasts like the Don Tony and Kevin Castle Show. And the MMA Insiders with Jason Floyd and Sam Kaplan. New shows like Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill. Entertainment shows like LOL with Nancy Alexander. And shows that'll make you think, like Dangerous Conversation with Scott Ledger.
We've got you covered.
You can find all our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.
You're listening to Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. Get the Crush blogs, podcasts, and performance links at CrushPerformance.com. Now, back to the show.
It is CrushPerformance.com. I am Jeff Crochelle. A fabulous evening to everybody. Very important topic today as we talk about Talent development ID with Dr. Joe Baker. Hey, before we get there, I've got to congratulate Anthony for getting into the draw for the TSN 1260 golf tournament. Hey, listen, we will be hosting the Crush Sherwood Dodge Hole-in-One Dodge Ram giveaway on the 10th. So do your very best, first of all, to get into the tournament, and then do your very best to practice your hole-in-one skills, because there's a Dodge Ram up for grabs. And closer to the hole, we'll receive one night and one round of golf at the incredible Trickle Creek Lodge, courtesy of First Tee Golf. And for more information on that, you can call First Tee Golf at 1-800-661-GOLF or check it out at info@firstteegolf.com. Waiting on the line patiently, Dr. Joe Baker from York University. Thanks for staying on, Dr. Baker.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, listen, a very interesting conversation today as we sort of work our way through the minutiae of development, talking about, you know, development, holding kids back early, redshirting, and we just sort of got into the conversation of relative age and the great Canadian model, the long-term athlete development model that Sport Canada's put together, and of course, right alongside that, coaching. And we just finished our conversation talking about, you know, what that means in terms of development overall. But if you look at something like, for example, the big soccer clubs in Europe, you know, they have their clubs really wired right down to the kids who are just starting to walk, for crying out loud, 5 years old, all the way up to their professional teams. Now that is a very, very focused developmental model.
Yeah, it is. And when we've worked with clubs in Europe, the reason they do that is not because they think that that kid has talent and they know that they're going to be a superstar. They do that so that another club doesn't have the option of snapping them up early. And there's a great example of a club in the Netherlands that signed a one-year-old to a 10-year contract just based on a YouTube video. And it's just so that in the really rare, super unlikely scenario that that person turns out to be the next Messi or Ronaldo, that they've signed them and it doesn't give the option to another club.
So let me ask you this. What on earth would drive a club to sign a one-year-old to a 10-year contract. And we did hear the story over here, of course, but it still just boggles my mind. You know, if we look at talent ID, let's talk about this for a second. Let's say we take 4, 5, 6-year-olds or even 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. What do you think the percentage or the accuracy of predicting future success is there, Dr. Baker? I'm not sure what the numbers are. I've seen some of them, you know, when we talk to our pro scouts, but we know for a fact it's not that good.
No, and it's essentially a crapshoot. And I'll give you an example. We did a study of handball players in Germany at the age of 13 and 14 years old. And we had coaches pick the ones that they thought were the most talented so they could move on in the system. And then 10 years later, we followed up with them to see who made it to the national team. And so there was somewhere, the coaches were somewhere around a 78% accurate. And then we went on the street and just stopped the average person, and we had them watch a 5-minute video of them playing, these same athletes playing in a scrimmage, and the average person on the street was about 75% accurate. And so it's that's not to trivialize what coaches do, but it's just to underline this idea that identifying talent seems like a simple thing, but it is such a complex task. And to sort of believe that we could do it under the age of 10, where we've got biology and maturation and different rates of growth interfering with this process, is essentially ridiculous.
We're talking with Dr. Joe Baker, a professor at the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences at York University. Yeah, it really does boggle my mind, and it's very frustrating. Again, probably with the best of intentions, everybody's out there trying to create opportunities for their kids. So let me ask you this. You know, we hear the big conversation about what does a top performer look like and why are some people top performers and others aren't. And there's some really great bodies of work out there that have painted some pretty interesting pictures. But one thing that's come out of it is the concept of deliberate practice. And I think this is a very interesting conversation and something that people might be able to sink their teeth into. What's your sort of view of the deliberate practice, I guess, statement?
Yeah, we've actually done a lot of work with this concept and elite athlete development. So the deliberate practice is a unique kind of training. So if you think about a swimmer who every day shows up at the pool and just sort of goes through the motions, the same old workouts they've always done, well, that's practice. Deliberate practice would be the same swimmer who shows up at the pool, knows exactly what they need to work on, is going through the hard intervals, the really effortful kinds of training that are specifically related to identifying weaknesses in their performance. So that's what deliberate practice is. It's not always the most enjoyable kind of training. It's focused on performance improvement. It's very effortful. And so what the evidence suggests is that this kind of training is really highly associated with improvements in skill. And so at the end of the day, if you look at people who are at the highest level of performance, the amount of time they've spent in deliberate practice is normally greater than people at lower levels of skill, which seems like a simple statement, do more deliberate practice. But it's actually a bit more complex than that because, you know, we have genes interacting with this. There's a unique gene that was just identified a few years ago that that might actually determine your ability to do deliberate practice in events like sprinting because it affects how elastic your tendons are. And if you don't have nice springy elastic tendons, well, you're not going to be able to train to the same extent as someone who's got those tendons. And so it seems like a simple thing. Yeah, just go and train more. But it's a bit more complex than that. And I think what shouldn't get lost, and I think if any of your listeners have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, or David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene, which are tremendous books, is sometimes what gets lost in the rhetoric is that deliberate practice is probably the single most important thing that we can do to improve our performance from one day to the next. Most of the time, each of us can look at our own performance, whether we're elite athletes or we're just trying to get better at playing the guitar or whatever, we can almost always identify something that we need to do better. It's not always fun to focus on those things, but if we do, we're probably going to become better performers as a result.
Dr. Joe Baker joins us, professor at the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences from York University. It's a very interesting conversation. And one other thing that goes along with this idea of deliberate practice, it has to be planned and progressive. I mean, it can't just be a shot in the dark. So that's another factor that we sort of have to put into the equation.
Yeah, absolutely. And to just to come back to a question you asked earlier that we didn't really get to about why the Dutch club would sign that one-year-old, they do it for the club so that they're sort of covering their bases, but they do it more importantly for the athlete so that the athlete's involved in the structure of the club. They get coaching, they get better players to play with, and so from a development standpoint, they do that because it's providing the best environment for development.
Well, and that's pretty interesting, and there is some valuable there, no value there, no question about it. I wonder if you look at the parents' genes and go, huh, okay, let's sign that kid. We want your firstborn signing this dotted line. Kind of an interesting concept. It's out there, but I'm sure it's coming.
Oh, it's out there for sure, and there are companies in the U.S. that parents can send a cheek swab of their kid to see if they have the genetic markers, and which is essentially, I think it's between $99 and $129, which is essentially throwing your money in the toilet, because the genetic factors that we have that have been identified, the research is not there yet to be able to make those kind of decisions.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about Gladwell's book and, of course, Epstein's book, and it's interesting to see these little talent hotbeds that Gladwell talks about, and we all know about them in the sporting world for sure. You know, the tennis courts in Russia, the, you know, look at the Korean female golf, you know, 40% of the top 20 female golfers right now come from Korea. This is not a mistake. This is a process of development that really, really does work, and it is out there, but there's still no guarantees.
No, and I think the one thing that you see with those kind of farm systems is the massive amount of talent that enters the program for the little few number of people that exit the program. And I think if that's your philosophy, which is almost the Chinese talent development model and the sort of East German model, if those are your approaches, then if you're not concerned about burning out most of your people who enter the system, then you can get away with that. In Canada, we can't normally get away with that because we just don't have the grassroots participation in a lot of the sports that we excel in.
Yeah, we just don't have the depth. It's the power of numbers, survival of the fittest, so to speak.
Absolutely. And you know, from a statistics standpoint and an athlete development standpoint, it's hard to argue with the Chinese model. They're very successful. But from us, like from a science perspective, we look at them, the population that they have, and the population that they have, they should be destroying every other country in the world, but they're not. The U.S. is close to them in the Summer Olympics and the Winter Olympics. You know, look at Norway, Norway is a country that has a population that's less than the city of Toronto, and it's always in the top five in Winter Olympics. And so one of the questions that we always ask is, what are they doing differently and how can we learn from them?
Yeah, and you should. And again, we do look around the world to learn. You look at what the Australians are doing, and Canada's not doing a bad job. Boy, if you look at our Winter Olympics and our population per capita, there's some really, really amazing things going on right here on our home turf.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at how we've done over the last few Olympic cycles, it's been where we focused resources and started to look at things in a more systematic and scientific way. And I don't think that's not a coincidence. And so when we put more resources in the system, we focus more on sort of owning the podium. We change the whole format of the way we look at high-performance sport. We do get superior performance as a result. The flip side of that is, do grassroots sports suffer when we do that? Yeah, I'm not so sure. I think the evidence that of the trickle-down effect when we have success in high-performance sport, whether that trickles down into grassroots level, is a bit of an open question at the moment.
And perhaps a question for another day. Dr. Joe Baker, fascinating conversation today. Listen, we appreciate all the work that you've done, your number of books that you've authored, and the plethora of research that's done. You can check it out at York University's website. I appreciate your time today. And you know what? I'll look forward to contacting you again, and maybe we'll tackle some of those unanswered questions from today.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks, Jeff. This was a lot of fun.
Great. Appreciate you and your time.
Okay. Bye.
All right. There's Dr. Joe Baker from the University, York University over in Ontario, Toronto, Ontario. Fascinating discussion, you know, talking about relative age, the developmental model, and also, you know, looking at the idea of talent and talent ID, trying to predict future success. It's just not that accurate. Again, we can go back to the Bantam draft conversation we had from a couple weeks ago. If you look at the Bantam draft, the top five players from 1997 to 2008, which is something that's been broken down, you'd be very surprised at the number of those players who never played a game in the NHL. In 1997, of the top five players in the Bantam draft, only one player played in the NHL. He played at the time of this study, played 764 games. That was Jarrett Stoll. If you look at 1999, again, only one of the top five played. You go to the year 2001, well, four of the five played in the NHL. And in 2008, only two players. Ty Radai played one game, and Ryan Nugent Hopkins, who we know very well, is still trucking away. So again, listen, be careful when you're trying to predict and put pressure on your young athletes, your students, and your children for future success. It'll roll out if you do things properly. We have to thank Dr. Joe Baker. Fascinating conversation today. We'll look forward to touching the base with him again. And also Bob Holtzman for his great report from Outside the Lines. Stay tuned next week. We have a very, very special guest on Crush Performance. We'll talk to you then.